when my mom was in the hospital just shortly before she died, she had a few things she needed to say to my dad. One of them was she needed him to promise that he would take care of himself, because my mom had always taken care of him. And so she a few times made him promise, to the extent where after she had died, I remember sitting in the funeral home with my dad at one point doing planning and things like that and talking about something to do with his health. And he said, "Your mom made me promise. If I don't take care of myself, she is going to punish me." So he's, and you know what? And he has taken it seriously that he made that promise. The other thing, it was funny, I was talking to my dad, and my dad is an extrovert. Pretty far off the charts extrovert. He really enjoys being with people, and he enjoys all sorts of things. And one of the roles he's taken on over quite a few years at their church is that in the morning he goes around and he greets all the various widows in the congregation, and he hugs many of them, and that's great, and they appreciate it, and he enjoys it. And when my mom was there with him, that was one thing. And then I had a little conversation with him where I said, "You know, Dad, you may need to rethink the way that you engage with the widows and everybody else in your life, because Mom's not there anymore, and you may be seen as a good catch. And so you just be aware of how you will be received." And it was an awkward thing for me to have the conversation with my dad, but I thought the opportunity came up, at which point he says, "Your mom already warned me. Your mom already told me that I have to watch how I'm interacting and all of these kind of things." And I tell you all of this because we were privileged that when my mom was dying, we knew she was dying. And she knew that she was dying. And so she was able to take the time to say the things that she needed to say, to tell us all that she loved us, things like that, right? When you don't know, when it's a sudden death, I think there's a lot of things that are harder because you don't have that opportunity to say your last words, to say the things that are so important to the people you love. Jesus, when we get to chapter 13 of John, knows that this is it. And for the next four chapters, they're all of Jesus' last words. These are the things that Jesus is looking at his disciples from this part of chapter 13 all the way through to the end of chapter 17. This is Jesus looking and saying, "If you don't remember anything else about me, here are the things I want you to know. Here are the things I want you to hold on to." They're his final words. And they start just before the part which Tamara read. They start when Judas leaves the room. Jesus is having his last supper with his disciples. And then he's kind of said, "Listen, not all of you are going to be with me in this." And Judas takes that as his cue to go. He's going off. We know the story. He's going off to the high priest. He's going off to betray Jesus. It's the beginning of the end for Jesus. And then all these things are going to be happening after that, from his arrest and his trial and his crucifixion and ultimately his resurrection. It's all going to be happening next. But just before that happens, Jesus has all of these things to say. And so for the next few weeks, we're going to be looking at some of the things, only a portion, but some of the things that Jesus had to say as kind of his final word. These are the things I really want you, those of you who are my friends, those of you who've been traveling with me, living with me, right there with me for the last 3 years, these are the things I want you to hold on to. And so we read this, and this passage that starts at John 13:31, it starts... It's a little difficult to understand in the English language, but it's also difficult to understand in the Greek language because there's a word that gets used over and over and over again. And so sometimes it's hard. So it starts this way in verse 31. When Judas had gone out, Jesus said, here's where it gets a little weird. "Now the Son of Man has been glorified." Son of Man is a way that he refers to himself. "The Son of Man has been glorified, and God has been glorified in him, and God will glorify him," Jesus, "in himself, and will glorify him at once." There's a lot of glorifies and a lot of back and forth between God and Jesus and one in the other and the other in him. And it can get very complicated because sometimes that's trying to put these huge, big ideas into language. It is complicated. So I spent a lot of time trying to wrap my head around even what it means, what that word glorified means. The word glory is a little bit more familiar. It's a word that we use in worship. We sang it in a couple different songs that we sang. We referred to God's glory, by which we mean his splendor, his majesty. I think it's Ezekiel at one point. He writes about God's glory and he describes it as like a rainbow in the sky with bright, vibrant light. In Revelation, we have images of lots of jewels and precious gemstones to try and get at a sense of what God's glory is like. It's a splendor. When Moses, in the Old Testament, when Moses wanted to see God, God said, listen, my glory is way too much for your little human eyes to be able to manage. So what I'm going to do is hide you in this cleft in this rock where you're kind of hidden, you can't see me. And you'll see me just as I pass by. You'll see my glory just as I pass by. And so it's just a glimpse of the back end of God as he's going by. And that was enough. All of Moses' hair turned white. And he came down off the mountain after that experience. And he was glowing just from that glimpse of God's glory. And so when we think about God's glory, we think of something magnificent, majestic, indescribable. Something that our brains can't even really wrap around. Because it's the true divine, which is so much bigger than us. So when you switch that word from God's glory to God being glorified, then what does that mean? The word is defined as making glorious or making splendid or excellent. It's described as being honored, being praised, being admired, being worshipped. And so think about it this way. So Judas has gone out, and with Judas leaving the building, with Judas leaving that supper, all the events that we call the passion, which is the whole end of Jesus' life, all the way through to the resurrection, all of that is launched with Judas going out. It's kind of like up until that moment, the story could have gone either way because Judas at the last moment could have made a different decision or something else. Judas leaves, and that marks this is the beginning of the end here. And so that's why Jesus says, now it begins. Now the Son of Man is a way that Jesus sometimes referred to himself. There's Old Testament prophetic overtones of that title, but he's just talking about himself. So, and kind of weirdly in the third person, but that's what he's doing. He's just talking about himself. Now, with Judas's departure, with the beginning of the end, with the launching of all the things that are going to result in me dying on a cross and then being raised up from the dead, now I have been glorified. Now I have been made glorious, splendid, excellent. Now I have been honored, praised, admired. It's weird to me that Jesus is talking about the cross in those kind of glowing words. And none of the other gospel writers talk about the cross in those kind of glowing words. With the other gospel writers, the resurrection is that moment of glory, of that splendor and everything like that. But John takes the whole story, including the violence and the hate and the ugliness and the pain of the cross. And that's also wrapped up into this statement that now the Son of Man has been glorified. With all of this, what John also talks about Jesus being lifted up on the cross, but he kind of paints this image of Jesus lifted up, hanging on a cross, and we see the blood and the scars and the pain, but John looks at it from kind of sometime further in the future, and he looks at it, and he sees Jesus lifted up as one to be worshipped. That's kind of what it means to be glorified. The Son of Man has been glorified in all of this, and God has been glorified in him. Because Jesus does this, because this is the story, because Jesus is perfectly obedient in this, I don't think Jesus was under any illusions about what was coming. He knew what was coming. He had skirted death a few times. Death by stoning had been the thing that people had preferred earlier. He knew what was coming. He was a typical Roman person who was used to walking down major highways and seeing people crucified hanging on the side of the roads. That was the way Rome liked to kill people. And so it wasn't a foreign concept to him. He knew the pain. He knew the suffering that was coming his way. And yet he went there willingly because he knew that God had a greater purpose and a greater plan in mind. And he was perfectly obedient in that. Can you imagine? Can you imagine knowing that's going to be your end and still being, I will continue to make all the choices that are going to lead to there. I love people so much. I love God's creation so much that I am willing to do whatever God asks, even if it means that. Our cross doesn't look dangerous and horrible and painful, but it was. It was more excruciating than most of the suffering that we have come up with since the Roman Empire to inflict on people. Because Jesus was perfectly obedient, because Jesus was the perfect Son of God, because Jesus was willing to go all the way to the cross to redeem, to save, to heal God's creation, God was also glorified in that. God was honored and praised and admired. God was made glorious, made splendid, made excellent in all of that. In the cross, we see exactly how far God was willing to go for us. Because God and Jesus are one. And so as Jesus suffered and died on that cross, God suffered horrendously. God was willing to endure that because of how much he loved us. That's what it means that God has been glorified in Jesus. And then we read, it continues on, well, if God has been glorified in him, which we know he has because Jesus has just said God has been glorified in Jesus. If God has been glorified in him, God will glorify Jesus in himself. This is where all the pronouns and things can get a little struggling. Think about it this way. God will make Jesus glorious, splendid, to be honored by sustaining him perfectly through what's coming so that Jesus can remain perfectly faithful through to his final breath. In Jesus' human strength and human power, he did not have what it took to endure what he endured. No human being could do that. The mocking, the humiliation. There was a point where he was hanging on the cross and people were saying, hey, if you truly are the Son of God, why don't you just let yourself down? We know this is the Jesus who raised people from the dead. He could have just hopped off the cross, I'm sure. I'm sure he had the power that he could have done that if he wanted. And people were tempting him with that, saying, why not? Prove to us that you're the Son of God. We'll all follow you. You'll prove that you're Messiah if you just hop off that. That would be better than death, wouldn't it? If you could somehow just make yourself not feel the pain of it all, that would be better than what he was enduring. But Jesus endured it all, and he endured it all through the power and the strength of God himself who gave him the power. So when God says that he will glorify Jesus in himself, what he's saying is that God has given Jesus everything he needs to endure what he is called to do, to be able to have the strength to go through the horrors and the pain and the suffering of the cross. And then he says, and will glorify him, Jesus, will glorify him at once. So we've gone from now, Jesus is glorified, with the launching of the end, Jesus is glorified, to God will glorify him in the future with the resurrection. He's looking ahead. 3 days after all of that, Jesus is going to be raised up from the dead. So he's not just lifted up on the cross, but he's raised up to life out of death. And in that, that's what our worship is based on. When we glorify God, when we worship God, when we celebrate God, when we proclaim that God is awe-inspiring, when we proclaim his indescribable majesty, when we sing songs of worship where we try and with music and words, we try and get a little bit of a sense of how extraordinary God is, all of that is because of what Jesus did on the cross and how God raised him up from the dead afterwards. So Jesus is saying here in this beginning of his words to his disciples, his final words, he knows what's coming. They still don't really get what's coming. They know things are a little bit tense, but they don't really get what's coming. I think he said these words because he wanted to give them a sense of what the whole story was. Now, I don't know that it helped them much in the moment because it took them a long time to really understand the whole picture. But I think he started this way. And John has included this at the beginning of the dialogue because he wanted us and he wanted them to really get that this whole story of the crucifixion and the resurrection isn't just a story out of history that we pluck out and we go, oh, let's center a religion around this thing that we believe may or may not have happened. It's not that. It's Jesus saying, there is something of cosmic significance happening here. There is something of the divine happening here. There is something that despite what it looks like, despite that it looks like true and pure evil, there is something glorious and magnificent that God is doing in here. And that in the end, when God in the future will glorify Jesus at once, that's speaking to that resurrection, saying the cross does not get the final word. Death does not get the final word. The suffering, the pain, the violence, the hate, none of that gets the final word. God is glorified. Jesus is glorified. We worship God. We worship Jesus because they get the final word. And that final word is life, and that final word is health and wholeness. It's redemption, which is about taking all that's awful and turning it to something good. Now, this had to do specifically with the story of Jesus' death and his resurrection, but it also has to do with our lives. Because let's be honest, when we're in the middle of our own suffering, when we're struggling, when we are in pain, when we are feeling the violence and hate of the world around us too deeply, when we're in those dark places and we can't claw our way out, it's incredibly important to remember that God is who God says he is. That the same God who rose Jesus up from the grave, the same God who didn't leave Jesus for a moment while he hung on that cross, is with us in our dark times. And just like the death and the crucifixion resulted in life eternal, not just for Jesus, but for all who follow in his footsteps. So our darkness, our suffering, our pain is never the final word. That God is with us in the midst of it. Now, it's true that when Jesus was hanging on the cross, one of the things he said, he quoted a psalm and he said, my God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus experienced what must have been an incredibly horrendous absence of God. But just because we experience the absence of God doesn't mean that God is actually absent. God doesn't leave us. God doesn't forsake us. God is with us in all of it. And I think the story of Jesus, and I think these words are a reminder from Jesus that he's with us in the midst of whatever it is that we're in the middle of as well. And so he set this stage where he's taken this event in history and he's recognized that it's something bigger. It's about who God is. It inspires the worship of God. And then he says directly to his disciples, little children. He doesn't really use that much in this gospel, but in other letters that John wrote, he talks to the disciples, little children. It's a term of endearment. And he says, I'm only going to be with you a little longer. He says, you will look for me. And just as I said to the Jews, which are just his non-disciples, so I say to you now, where I'm going, you can't come. Now, he's going to come back to that later, but in this passage, he leaves it at that. Because what he really wants to say to them is, I'm going to be away from you, and you can't come with me. So here's what I want from you. And this is where we get into these final words, right? He's my mom saying to my dad, you must take care of yourself and watch the flirting. He's saying those things except to his disciples. And so what is it he has to say? What was so important to Jesus that it's the first thing he says to them, knowing his death is coming and knowing that, like, if you don't remember anything else I had to say, remember this. What is of so much importance? What is of so much precedence? I give you a new commandment that you love each other. Just like I've loved you, love each other. That's what I'm demanding, or that's what I'm commanding. That I'm going to be gone. I'm not going to be with you anymore. So love each other like I've loved you. Now, Jesus has just, this is at the Last Supper. What has Jesus just done? He's just gone around and he's washed his disciples' feet. He took on the role of the servant of the house.
He took off their shoes and he washed their feet in some cool water. He washed the dust from their travels off. He probably gently, any blisters and wounds that were on his feet, things like that, he gently medicated. He gently covered in cooling water. He served them. He took the role of the servant. And at the time, he said, I've set you an example that you also should do as I have done to you. So now when he says, I have a new commandment that you love each other like I've loved you, they've got that immediate example of Jesus going around the table and washing all of their feet. That's fresh in their minds. He's just done that moments ago, not so long ago. They've got that picture in their heads. And so when he says that to them, you will love each other as I have loved you, that's what he's referring to. That image of Jesus going around and washing their feet, it holds all the pieces of who Jesus is. It's about self-sacrifice. It's about putting yourself in the role of the servant to serve the others. Now, there's other places where he talks about loving your enemies, loving your neighbor as yourself. That's not what he's doing here. He's talking specifically to his disciples. He's talking specifically to the church. And he's saying, those of you, it wasn't a church yet, but those of you who will be my church, love each other the way I've loved you. I'm not going to be with you anymore. This is it. This is how people are going to know that you belong with me, not because they see me in your midst, but because they see the way that you love each other. It's hard to balance loving each other with the rest of our lives, isn't it? Because loving each other in the way that Jesus loved his disciples, it can't be done in an hour on Sunday morning or 2 hours on Sunday morning. It can't be done just simply over some chit-chat and some touching base over coffee and cookies or whatever somebody brings out there. It's more than that. It's being aware enough to be praying for each other, knowing what's going on in each other's lives so that we can be praying for each other, knowing that when somebody is struggling, we know how to help and we're willing to set aside what we need so that we can help. It's about being willing to take that posture of the servant toward each other. Can you imagine a church where everybody served each other? Where people's biggest argument was over who got to serve first and who got to serve most? No, let me make you coffee. No, I want to bring that person coffee. Let me visit you when you're sick. No, I want to visit you when you're sick. No, let me give you some money. No, I want to give you some. Can you imagine a church where that's what we were fighting about? What a pleasant, I don't know, churches that fight over carpet colors and things like that. I just think, how marvelous would it be if we were fighting over who got to serve the most? Not that I think we should fight at all. Let me clarify that. But this is what Jesus is saying. I'm not going to be with you anymore. But if you want people to know that you're mine, if you want to continue on in this life that has begun as my disciples walking with me, learning from me, being with me, then treat each other the way that I have treated you. That's what it means to be the church. That's what we're called to. It's kind of basic. It's kind of simple. Love each other the way that I've loved you. Just like Jesus, I don't think could have endured all the suffering of the cross in his own human power. I'm here to tell you that we can't love each other the way that Jesus loved his disciples in our own human power. We can try, but it's not going to work. Our sin gets in the way of that. So, and we're going to get here in a few weeks when we get to the incredible Pentecost things, but the Holy Spirit empowers us. The Spirit of Jesus, who is alive and raised from the dead, empowers us and makes it possible for us to love each other. Our loving each other, our following this new commandment, isn't about us trying in all of our power to do this great thing. It's about us surrendering ourselves to Jesus so that Jesus can love through us. It's taking the stance of open hands rather than closed fists, of open hands so that the Spirit can come in. It's taking away our own rights over our own time and our own resources, and instead allowing Jesus to determine how our time and our resources will be used, again, for his glory, for the loving of each other. they will know that Walmer is filled with disciples of Jesus by the way that we love each other.